heavily, I'm a clown.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Bitcoin Echo Chamber, the show about Bitcoin and Bitcoin virtual reality meetups. Got an interesting interview for you guys today with Alex Gladstein, someone that I admire very much. He works with the Human Rights Foundation and he is a bit of a watchdog for oppressed peoples and living conditions around the world. I've always enjoyed listening to him talk and I've always hoped that I would one day get the chance to speak with him, so I was really excited when I was able to connect with him for this interview. I think you guys are really going to like it. Alex didn't have a whole lot of time, so we tried to hit on as many topics as we could in a short amount of time, so forgive me for not diving into certain things in more depth like you guys know I like to do. Anyway, let's get on to the interview and I will come back and talk to you guys at the end. This episode of the Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast is sponsored by WTFHappenedIn1971.com, the economics meme taking the world by storm where all of us are trying to find out the answer to what the heck happened in 1971. WTF 1971 also has a merch store now. You can find it at wtf-1971.creator-spring.com. I'll post a link to that down in the show notes if you want to check it out. Thanks for the support. Alex, how you doing, man?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. I've always wanted to get the chance to talk with you. World's getting kind of crazy, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seems like we're quickly descending to the edge of the cliff, so to speak.
Well, no one knows what's going to happen. None of the experts know. So it's unprecedented territory.
Seems that way. One of the things that I admire the most about you, and I've tried to emulate this in my own analysis of the world, is your criticisms of loss of liberty around the world tend to be politically agnostic. And I admire that because I think particularly as Americans, we tend to get caught up in a certain sense of nationalism when it comes to criticizing everyone else's situations, but not so much our own. Can you talk a little bit about like how you form your analysis of the world in that regard?
Well, I think there's two competing bad perspectives. One is what you just referenced, that we're very proud of our own society and we only want to criticize others. But actually, the one that I encounter more is the one that ignores what's happening elsewhere and focuses only on criticizing the United States. That one to me is much more common. That's the sort of take I see a lot more. Democracies, open societies like the United States, Britain, Japan, etc., Israel, all these others, for all their flaws, they receive the lion's share of all the criticism in the world, mainly because they have the journalists working in companies that are legal to operate in their jurisdictions. Whereas if you think about Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Cuba, any number of countries across the Middle East and Sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, many of these places are authoritarian and it's, not even possible to run a independent media outlet there. So, the bulk of the world's journalism content comes from open societies and those societies are under a magnifying glass, whereas people could care less about Laos or about Cameroon or about Bhutan or about Swaziland, because they just don't care and there's no voices that are reaching the global media landscape from within. That they're silenced or they're too soft or they don't have the right tools to get out there, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say the two perspectives that concern me are, yes, of course, the one that says, whatever, my country's the best and therefore let's just criticize everyone else. That's a bad take, but so is the take that's like, well, I'm not comfortable criticizing others and we should only criticize our own country. So my work with the Human Rights Foundation, which has a mission focus on closed societies, has colored my worldview and my opinion, which is to say we should have a lot of empathy, a lot of humility, and try to mix those two, I would say, bad takes together into a good take, which would be, let's pay careful attention to what's happening in our own societies and use the levers we have to protect liberties as we can. But also remember that most people don't have the luxuries of these levers of accountability that we have. Most people in the world, 4+ billion people, are operating in a society that doesn't have a free press, where they don't have a voice to speak, where they don't even have free speech, where they can't create an NGO or, you know, an advocacy group without being arrested. Whether they're an environmentalist or a poet or a stamp collector or a sports club, it doesn't matter. They're just, you can't have an independent voice inside a dictatorship or an authoritarian regime. So I try to strike a balance between warning people about eroding conditions, maybe in my own country, but also understanding that the greater global threat is authoritarianism, and the more dire situation is out there in places where people don't have the amazing, I would say, constitutional protections and liberties that we have here.
Yeah, you know, I think where I see that highlighted and what gives me a lot of perspective is when I see these incidences that make their way to social media through firsthand account. They're not reported by any media organization. You see them spread virally through something like Twitter. And you'll see these major loss of liberty situations or just abhorrent living conditions that are created by some sort of government monopoly or government policy. And those types of things, were they to happen in the Western world, particularly in the United States, the outrage would be, you know, astronomic. It'd be unlike anything that we complain about today. And it's actually a good perspective, I think, that you say that, that we do remember, we do have it pretty good here, at least relatively speaking.
I mean, let me just read you part of the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I mean, that you read that to anyone who lives in Saudi Arabia or China or North Korea or Russia or Turkey or Libya or Zimbabwe or Cuba or Venezuela, or I could go on and on and on, their mind would be blown. Wait, that's what our society's based on? That's amazing. You know, they'd go crazy. So we take this for granted, but our Constitution actually protects some really, really important rights and freedoms. Now, have they been trampled on unconstitutionally? Yes. But we need to like be aware of that. We need to fight back and understand that, like, at least our legal precedent, at least our court system, you know, is likely to want to actually uphold and defend these principles. And our court system is not under the thumb of the executive or the legislature. It's its own branch. It's independent. And this balance of power is what ultimately has allowed the U.S. To survive as long as it has, and hopefully a lot longer in search of a better society. I mean, I think we need to rely on these kind of these freedoms and protections of liberty to get us to where we want to be. We're not where we want to be. There's a lot about our country that's broken and flawed. But the problem is not the First Amendment, okay? The problem is violations of the First Amendment. The problem is censorship. The problem is corruption. The problem is incompetence. The problem is lackadaisicalness towards civil liberties. These are the problems that beset our country, not the fundamental bedrock that we stand on. And that's the difference. You live in China, the problem is both. The problem is the fundamental bedrock where Xi Jinping has written his name into the prologue of the charter of the country, plus all the incompetence and corruption and lies and secrecy and dictatorship. Like, we at least have something to fall back on. So it's really, really important to not lose sight of that and to not take it for granted. And maybe that's only something that I've learned through just repeated interactions over a decade plus of people who would kill for just a day of life this way. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, just who would sacrifice so much just for a fraction of the liberties that we have. So this is just so, so important that we not lose sight of it. And when you understand it properly, it gets you very excited and you want to defend it. So there's no bad outcome here. You can direct your newfound energy to fighting in America domestically for our freedoms, which many others do. We have about 70 or 80,000 nonprofits, and a lot of them are political ones fighting for different kinds of rights and liberties. You got to understand that most people live in a country where, I mean, I say most, but let's just call it 52%-ish of the world lives in a country or society where they can't even do that. You can't even have an ACLU type thing or an EFF or whatever. You'd be put in prison immediately. So again, let's not take our rights and freedoms for granted. Let's fight for them. Let's cement them. But let's, I would say even more importantly, be aware that others don't have them, and let's be empathetic towards them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would think, you know, I think where a lot of Americans lose touch with reality is they lose track of what our framework was established on, you know, the constitutional first principles, like you said. And then, you know, for juxtaposition, you look at a country like China, whose modern political spectrum was built on the back of a communist revolution, you know, and a pretty nasty revolution at that, death tolls in the millions, hundreds of millions, maybe even potentially. It really puts things into perspective for the framework that we enjoy, you know, even to this day, is worth protecting, just because that is the only thing that's guaranteed the freedoms that we have. So you and I got in contact because you stumbled across a website that my friend and I made called WTF Happened in 1971. And I'm interested to know a little bit about your take on this, because Ben and I made this website just because we were amazed by the data anomalies that took place as the Western world transitioned away from the gold standard and into full-blown fiat money. And mm-hmm. I've long speculated that it's this evaporation of our financial sovereignty that has caused an acceleration towards destruction of civil liberty in the West. And I'm really interested to hear why you thought that this website was interesting and what some of your thoughts are.
Well, I'm not an economist. I am a human rights and democracy expert. That is my domain. However, I've tried to do as much prep and research and reading recently about the history of the financial system, both in my country and abroad. And it's very important to me because I view financial freedoms and rights as absolutely essential. And my work with Bitcoin over the last few years has taught that to me, right? And what's amazing is just the lack of consensus in people about what has happened. Whereas when you remove economics from the equation, things seem to be a lot more clear. Like, most people seem to have a similar narrative of what happened in World War II, generally speaking. But it appears that the experts certainly are in complete disarray about what caused the Great Depression, for example. So, you know, you have a group of people who believe that it was because we tried to hold on to the gold standard. This is like probably the meta narrative. This seems to be like dominant among academic textbooks and sort of the I guess economist perspective is that this really showed that the gold standard was, you know, unworkable, and that as societies tried to hold on to the gold standard, they experienced crushing deflation and contraction and depression. On the other hand, there's a bunch of people who believe that, contrary to that, that the only reason we had the crisis in the first place was because of inflation beyond the gold standard and the previous decade's excesses and over leverages. And that just to see these two competing narratives, and that, like, no, you know, they're just arguing for decades and decades and decades. And it's even more complicated and nuanced than that. Then you have someone like Friedman, who's like in the middle, right? And he's like, well, he's certainly not an Austrian, but he's not a Keynesian either. He's somewhere in the middle, you know? And you have all these different takes on why bad things happened in the last 100 years with regard to the economy. And you have such a strong, it just seems like there's so, like, people who are in the mainstream, let's say, their distaste for the gold standard is so strong. It's like, in their mind, it's like so obviously a bad idea for all of these reasons that they write out. And on the other hand, you have the Austrians and even monetarists or whatever, and they're like, no, like, it's actually good for us to have a system that looks more like that, and it's so obvious for all these reasons. And it's been amazing to me to like see that that this lack of consensus exists, and it's so fierce, you know. And it's very difficult for it's been very difficult for me to work through that as someone, you know, whose background is in human rights, democracy, etc., but also very illuminating. And I guess where it's brought me to today is that your website shows some, you know, inarguable trends and facts that tend to coincide with the closing of the gold window in 71. But on the other hand, regardless of that, we appear to be heading into a direction of more and more governments taking a more kind of modern monetary theory approach and basically saying, you know, we create the money and we can do it before we have tax revenue. And we, meaning politicians basically, should decide how much we print, shouldn't be an independent central bank, there shouldn't be a gold standard. We should just be able to print as much money as we need ad infinitum. And what will stop us is inflation and shortages. And when we get there, we'll stop printing money. And it just seems like that is the direction we're going in. And the funny thing is, it's not like, I think a lot of Bitcoiners are probably going to be like, looking at this situation, world, you know, catastrophic financial collapse, trillions of dollars being printed, the halving coming up. And they're not going to see hyperinflation, certainly not in the United States, at least in the near future. And they're going to be confused. Like, wait, how can we print trillions, but nothing really changes? And I think that that's a really interesting thing to discuss. Something that has led me to believe that I think Bitcoin and MMT will be like two of the big factors in the next decade, and their relationship will be very interesting, is what is basically my conclusion, is that policymakers are going to do more and more MMT. They're going to move away from this idea that running up a big deficit is bad for whatever reason. They're basically going to say they can't run out of money. And this kind of shrewd, more sort of careful, conservative monetarist philosophy that had driven a lot of central banks, you know, sort of up until this point, is going to be thrown out the window. And, you know, where that leads us, I don't know. But it's going to be really interesting to see that compared to the Bitcoin narrative, which anyone can opt into at any time. And, you know, for me, I'm sitting here and I'm like, hey, maybe they're right. I have no idea. Like, maybe MMT folks are right. And really all they're doing is describing how open market operations work in the first place. I mean, there is an argument that is the case, that we've been basically doing this the whole time, dating back to the 80s. you know, meaning printing money without having it first, and really like government unilaterally kind of having control over that, and obviously running up a massive deficit without caring about it. Like, we've been going in this direction a long time, and it's led to, you know, unprecedented growth, etc. So, you know, we may be going down the MMT road anyway, and that's going to start becoming more digital too. Like, all the MMT folks are trying to say we should have digital savings and checking accounts with the Fed and the Treasury, and we should be like disintermediating the commercial banks. And, you know, again, maybe that's better. I mean, would I prefer the bailouts to go to Boeing or to the people? Obviously to the people. So, you know, maybe they're leading us down a road that could conceivably be better inside the fiat system for people. However, I can't imagine that like long-term it doesn't lead to the devaluation of the dollar vis-a-vis other things. So, you know, at the same time, I think that while society seems to be going in the MMT direction, which is a continuation of all the trends that you're seeing out of your work that you've been looking at after 71, I don't know whether we could conclusively say that that's going to be better or worse for the average American in 10 years. But what I can say is it's pretty exciting that we have the Bitcoin alternative and that anyone can access it as a sovereign financial instrument that they can control. And that it just provides a different narrative that is not, you know, one can't really argue about it. Like, it's just, it exists. You know, it's interesting to read all this economic history and all the central bankers are going to argue about, should we do X or should we do Y? Well, with Bitcoin, you don't have a chance, meaning you don't have a choice. You don't have a choice in the matter. You cannot determine whether it's bad or good that you can have an opinion about whether it's bad or good that the monetary issuance works as it is, but you don't get to decide, right? So while we're going down this like MMT path, it seems, at least in the United States and around the world, as the Fed becomes the world's central bank, right? We have Bitcoin. So this is kind of what I'm really interested in observing, is this relationship between MMT and Bitcoin as we move forward.
So a lot of my conversation tends to focus on the economic side, but I do appreciate your perspective that it's you come more from the human rights side of things. So looking at this, and obviously, you know, you admitted like you're not an economist, but looking at this whole modern money theory experiment, do you foresee any human rights implications coming from this? I mean, obviously we're seeing sort of human rights implications happening now from a public health perspective, but are you foreseeing any of that happening from this monetary experiment?
Yeah, long-term for sure. I mean, look, the U.S. is very unique. There are reasons why the U.S. government can print trillions with no immediate adverse effects for the population. The demand for dollars around the world is like almost unquenchable because everybody has dollar-denominated debt and needs dollars to pay back their debt and needs dollars to do their contracts, et cetera, et cetera. There's just not enough dollars. And I don't even think the Fed could print it fast enough, from what I understand about the euro dollar and how the world works in that aspect. However, that's just now. I mean, that whole thing could break. We're not sure. Outside of the United States, where most people live, right, where 90%+ of the world lives, where people don't have the dollar as their native financial asset, yes, like abusive monetary control has meant human rights violations. And these are obviously most on display in hyperinflationary economies. But even under high inflationary economies, you see this as well. So governments have been able to seize the power of the purse to fund all kinds of ill and nefarious activities while essentially stealing from the people. And these are major human rights violations, which have led to the absolute destruction of whole countries in places like Venezuela and Iran and Eritrea and North Korea, and actually quite a few places where the government has, in some cases, like in Eritrea and North Korea, decided just to scrap the currency and introduce a new one. So the people who had been turning their time and energy into money to save over decades, all of a sudden one day found that all their time and energy was just in a statement declared worthless by the regime. So these two events both happened about 10 years ago in these two countries. And I learned about them from defectors, from people who'd escaped from these countries. I mean, it's not widely known, but around 10 years ago, both of these dictatorships, one in Northeast Asia, one on the Horn of Africa, just basically said to the population, we're introducing a new currency, the old one's worthless. And hearing this from human rights activists was incredible, because it's really, at the end of the day, these kind of things are what drive revolutions. No one has like a map of the United, I mean, no one's the dreaming of like Jeffersonian democracy. No, they go out on the street because of economic frustrations. So I think they're very, very closely linked. If you look at Bouazizi, the guy who sparked the Arab Spring, he was pissed off because he couldn't sell his fruit in a cart. I mean, it's a very basic economic consideration. A lot of revolutions are driven by protests over rising prices, et cetera, stale wages, et cetera, et cetera. Much more so than like dreams about an open society. So I think that the abuse of the economy by dictators and authoritarians is very, very linked to both the progress of democracy and human rights activism. We live in a very privileged, unique place here in the United States where that's not really the case. And because we've been able to export a lot of our, I would say, monetary abuse to other people, we don't have to really worry about that right now. I mean, maybe we do, but it seems unlikely. I mean, it seems like if anything, we're going to have some deflation and then maybe some mild inflation, and then maybe it'll get worse. But over the next couple of years, that's kind of what it looks like. I mean, maybe there's obviously going to be deflation in assets, but as far as like shortages. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, look, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just read something yesterday saying there's going to be meat shortages in the United States next month. But that's not because of the money printing. That's because of the virus, right? So it all could kind of come together in a perfect storm here. But all I'm just trying to get at is like Americans have it very special and unique, and our government's ability to print more money without disrupting our lives is not normal. Like the normal reality for most people around the world is when their government does that, bad things happen. Human rights violations happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I would argue that the shortages are probably more so caused by things like price fixing, anti-price gouging laws and those types of things, but we don't have to get really into that. But so
sure. But the article I was reading about is like basically all these like pork and beef manufacturers are having to shut down their factories because of supply chain shocks and issues relating to the virus.
Right.
There's plenty of demand and there's plenty of cattle, but they can't, and there's plenty of pigs, but they can't process them. Therefore they're having to euthanize them. Right. The whole thing's fucked. But regardless, we could be seeing a situation where we have shortages of major goods here, even in the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously we saw what's happened with toilet paper so far. But again, I think that the average American, you know, again, their currency will remain fairly robust compared to everybody else. So all I'm trying to get at here is that like, we are very special and we have a different standard than everybody else because our government's currency is the one that everybody else wants. But that's not satisfying or gonna make anyone feel better if they're not American. Like their currency's gonna, those currencies, a lot of those emerging market currencies have already been getting crushed and are gonna continue to get crushed. And a lot of those countries have really bad sort of like asset liability ratios. A lot of them are heavily reliant on things like oil exports. It's going to be such a mess for so many of these governments. And unfortunately, what they're going to resort to is the money printer.
Right.
And it's going to devalue the savings of their citizens. And that's where we're going to actually see the devastating effects of inflationary policies is in emerging markets.
Right.
But like probably not in the United States, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, Americans are just really lucky, but for the world, it's really awesome that Bitcoin exists because it gives folks an option. They can permissionlessly without a authorization from anyone or having to ask anybody, they can start turning their Naira or their pesos or their RMB into Bitcoin and they can opt out of the system and they can take control. And they can be subject to the volatilities of Bitcoin, but they can know that it won't be some bureaucrat making a decision about the value of their currency.
Right.
That to me is like very, very powerful.
Yeah. It also enables, like what happened the other day with Bitcoin Twitter, where the kid that lives in Colombia, just random Bitcoiners started donating to him and made him a whole Bitcoin, you know, out of these donations. And that amount of money was equivalent to 3 years of wages for him or something like that. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, that was good to see. Good on American HODL for doing that.
So in regards to, I think it would be fair to say that a lot of Americans live close to the margin, even though, you know, we have a much better standard of living than a lot of other people in the world. And I'm sure that economically speaking, this shutdown caused by the virus, or whether you could say maybe exacerbated.
Well, caused by the authorities in reaction to the
virus. Exactly. Yes. Exacerbated by the authorities, perhaps. You know, but regardless, for the sake of conversation, we've seen a similar reaction around the world, and in places where I know people have are much closer to the margin than many Americans are. Like I think to Hong Kong, for example, where people, you know, pay 250,000 Hong Kong dollars to live in a 10 square meter apartment. What are some of the implications, or what have you been seeing in regards to this effect that's having?
Well,
in the more marginalized parts of societies.
To just build off what I was just saying before, even though Americans are privileged, even though our currency is probably going to remain really strong if you just track the DXY, I mean, against other currencies, it doesn't change the fact that most Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, right? I mean, I think the average American family has negative savings or something like that. So a 1 to 2 month potentially a lot longer disruption is going to be catastrophic. I mean, we're already seeing in my country, we're seeing what, we have 22 million unemployed formally, but probably closer to 30. The St. Louis Fed projected that by midsummer we'd have 60 million unemployed. We're going to have 30 to 35% unemployment here. That is unprecedented and catastrophic. I mean, we just don't know what that's going to look like. And I think anyone expecting a V-shaped recovery is crazy. But all that said, I mean, we will be faring better here than folks in most places, right? And I think we just need to consider that the policies of today will not be tolerated in the future. I don't see a situation where citizens don't get pissed off and rise up in some way, shape, or form. I'm not sure what that looks like. I think a lot of the problem is that a lot of citizens don't understand how the money system works. So they're not really aware of what's happening and how like the governments and people in charge are taking advantage of the fact that they are so close to the creation of money, and then they can divert it to wherever they want, and they can kind of like employ favoritism and make sure that the people that are lining their pockets get saved first. I mean, it's just kind of obvious in America, like who's getting bailed out faster? You know, it's like the corporations or the people. Well, obviously the corporations. A lot of people I know, some people got their stimulus checks, other people haven't even gotten them yet. So it's like, but guess what? Look at all these like hedge funds that have gotten like rescued. So it's like, people are going to get pretty pissed off about that. Now, I don't know what the reaction is. In some countries, it's going to mean revolution. In some countries, it's going to be violent protests. It's going to get rough out there. But the cool part is we now have a global peaceful revolution we can do, and that's called Bitcoin. So regardless of what society you live in, regardless of what currency you try to make ends meet with, you can convert your time and energy into Bitcoin. And that's a big, big deal. So this is the first, obviously, major global financial crisis where people have had that option. Now, again, most people don't understand that option, and we're really, really early. But for the folks who've done the work and have put the time in and understand Bitcoin, I mean, we're all very grateful. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're like, okay, I mean, things might be going to shit, and like, that's unfortunate. And let's see what we can do to help our communities and stuff. But man, I'm happy there's Bitcoin. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I think that's kind of a fallback thing, which nobody had in 2008 or in 2001 or in the late 80s, or if you were in Japan in the 90s or and into the 2000s. Like, there's no in these other situations, or in Nigeria in the 90s when the dictator tried to peg the naira to the dollar, and it obviously didn't work, and the black market exchange rate got like 4-1, but everybody's public wages were remaining static and everybody started starving. Like, nobody had an option like Bitcoin before, but now they do. And I just think that is such a massive boost for humanity. I just wish more people knew about it.
Yeah, I think that the world would look much more pessimistic from my vantage point if that option wasn't there. And more than just a money thing, you know, just this 2 months of time where people are forbidden from working, you know, maybe not everybody, but in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. the majority of the population.
Correct.
Do you think that we're going to see, you know, maybe like a little bit of bargaining going on where states say, okay, well, you're allowed to go back to work, but in exchange, you know, we're going to have to monitor more of your life. We're going to have to take a little bit of your privacy. And will people become desperate enough that they'll want to or be willing to give that up more willingly?
Yeah, I mean, I think yes to both. Number one, we're seeing this in China already. The government is trying to make a trade-off where they say, hey, okay, we're going to open up Wuhan, but you'll have to use this app and you can only go to your job or leave your home or get on a public transit if your app says you're green. If it says you're yellow or red, you're not going anywhere. So they've already introduced yet another level of mass surveillance on top of everything else they had as a result of the virus. And as you know, as the old Soviet joke goes, nothing's more permanent than a temporary measure. So that's not going anywhere. And that's going to spread far and beyond the cities they've rolled that out in. You know, there's going to be a lot of color coding in our future. On the other hand, yeah, people are desperate. At the end of the day, they've got to eat and put food on the table for their family. So they're going to agree to whatever they need to agree to make that happen. So unfortunately, the most vulnerable and the folks that have the least amount of resources are going to say yes the fastest to any sort of surveillance scheme because they can't afford to protest. They just can't. So, you know, Jameson Lopp did that great piece or participated in that great piece about maybe 2 years ago at the New York Times where it was basically him revealing that it cost him about $30,000 USD to disappear and to become private. Privacy and surveillance fighting technologies are going to be are you know experimental and they're hard to understand and they take time and they're most likely going to be disproportionately used by people who have like at least a decent amount of resources who have free time. Do you know what I mean? To burn. And we're unfortunately going to start seeing this grow as a result of coronavirus, but this is going to get exacerbated. The privacy inequality situation, like people who again have like a worse economic situation are not most likely going to be able to take the proper privacy measures for them and their family because they want that they have a higher Maslow's needs situation where they need to put food on the table first. Whereas whereas a lot of like people who are in white collar situations, middle class, upper class type people, they can work from home just fine. And they might have more, they may have time to explore things like how to stay private, how to use Bitcoin, things like that. So, I mean, I absolutely think you're going to see like an exacerbation on class lines with regard to privacy and surveillance.
And privacy is always like a cat and mouse game too, you know, and you're seeing this already in South Korea where the South Korean government wanted to monitor the people through their cell phones, collect data that way to monitor for public health. And then people started leaving their phones at home because they knew that the government was monitoring their movements. So now the government's making anybody who was leaving their phone at home wear the tracker bracelet. Did you see that story?
Yeah. So here's the deal. Even in democracies, even in South Korea and Taiwan, you're seeing the governments being tempted by mass surveillance, right? Even if it's not clear that it works. Thankfully, those are democracies where the people can fight back and there can be accountability, there can be elections, et cetera, investigations. But even in those countries, you're seeing geofencing and you're seeing location bracelets and you're seeing combinations of surveillance of public health data with financial data with public health data. And that's specifically in South Korea. The authorities are going nuts in terms of surveilling everybody. And they're even doing like public doxing. Like, so people, when people are ID'd as positives, they're put on some website with like a bunch of information about them. So they've gone way overboard. And at the end of the day, like, is their performance because of people wearing masks and hand washing and social distancing and, you know, knowledge of how to deal with things like SARS and coronavirus, or is it because of mass surveillance? No, it's because of the former. But the governments are seizing the opportunity, right? In Taiwan, you're seeing a little bit of citizen pushback, and like actually the government is so transparent that like you can go into parliament and actually just interview the government and be like, hey, did you do X, Y, or Z? And it looks like citizens are pushing back a little bit on the mass surveillance. And the government even admitted that all of its mass surveillance was only helpful in one case. So it's just like, if you actually look at the data, there's very little independent scientific work being done to show that digital contact tracing or using mass surveillance to fight coronavirus even works. However, nobody cares about that. All these people online are like posting about, oh, the new digital contact tracing and Bluetooth beacon tracking, and how cool is it that Apple and Google are teaming up to spy on us? And it's just nuts. So you're seeing a whole bunch of people in journalism and science and technology who are quite influential get really excited about Apple and Google's new thing without even stopping to think if it's even worthwhile. Like, wait, like, does this even work? We've heard from the Singaporean and Taiwanese authorities that digital contact tracing is not going to replace contact tracing, which is a very important way to fight any sort of outbreak, which is when you have a sick person at a hospital, you sit them down, you interview them, you talk to them about who they came into contact with, and you just call those people and you say, hey, this person's sick. You might want to take care of yourself. So that's how you like do contact tracing. This idea of like using your phone's Bluetooth technology to see who you came close to within a certain number of meter radius, I mean, where to even begin? I mean, first of all, can't even tell if you were in a bathroom stall or in the same room as somebody, or whether there was a wall between you. It has no idea. Number two, it promises to be privacy protecting, and I even think there's issues with that. If you actually look at the tech that they've shown, people like Moxie Marlin Spike have shown that there are vulnerabilities even at that level. But even if you assume it's utopian and noble, I mean, Apple and Google aren't building the apps. Governments and other companies are. So those apps are going to definitely suck up your PII, you know? And it's like slippery slope to color coding. And thirdly, it's like, what? So now everybody's got to like have their Bluetooth functionality on all the time. Like that seems like another attack vector. Right. It opens you up for exploitation by companies from like a sales and marketing point of view. And just in general, this idea that like we're gonna get excited about granting two companies the power to create a much more accurate surveillance network for 1/3 of all the citizens of the world through Bluetooth, which is again is accurate to the inch vis-a-vis cell phone GPS type tracking, which is less accurate. Like we're gonna get excited about that. Is the one of the craziest things I've actually ever seen. But so in many ways, coronavirus is normalizing mass surveillance, and it's very concerning, and it's a culture war that no one's really looking at, and it's being won by people who are ignorant.
Yeah, you know, the Bluetooth thing is also like a device vulnerability too, for like all of your personal devices that you have to maintain Bluetooth on. It's like leaving your back door open when you leave your house. Just having it on all the time.
Also, how are they going to fight against like, you know, false positives? Like basically right. They're relying on, apparently if it's sovereign and private, you're the one that's got to tell the app that you're sick. Like what if you're just messing around? Like there's just, when you have a system like that relies on human input of data, there's going to be screw ups. Like this is why you need a centralized system for something like that, so that someone can go in and double check it. Like most of these things don't require decentralization. Like, and this is just a window dressing kind of like whitewashing PR campaign to get you to think that we can do digital contact tracing in a way that's private. It's just not true. Right. The way we would actually have to do it requires breaking your privacy. And maybe that's a conversation that we should have, but like governments should be, and companies should be open about it. They should be honest about it, as opposed to trying to claim that it's technologically possible to do it in an encrypted way when it's just not the case. You know, maybe you can do a decent job at the protocol level, but not at the app level, man, not at the app level. So I just think it's something we all need to be really pissed off about and resist and make them prove. The burden of proof is on them. I'd like to see some studies showing that this thing actually works before them rolling it out. Like, and what, it's supposed to come next month? Who knows? Most of the United States may even have flattened the curve by then. We're on the downswing. Like, is that the time to introduce mass surveillance? Like what, the whole thing reeks of opportunism and just a catastrophe with regard to civil liberties.
That information is a liability too. You know, you mentioned the public doxing website. I think you said it was the Taiwanese government that did that.
No, South Korean government. Basically, when they find out you're positive, they put all your information up on like a website that other people can see.
That's basically like community enforced social credit system, because it's like, you know, that could lead to blacklisting from businesses.
Well, at least the scarlet lettering, tar and feathering, all kinds of stuff.
Right.
So terrible idea. I mean, there are many ways to fight the virus. The virus is very serious. Look, I shared a Venn diagram that I hope makes clear my position. And it had three circles. One said, COVID is very dangerous. It is not the flu. Just to give one data point, more people are dying every day in New York City than any other time since 9/11. It's not the flu. It's very dangerous, very contagious. And that's something you can accept, while at the same time, one of the other circles was the economic devastation from the shutdown is going to be very dangerous, and I'm very worried about that. While at the same time, the other circle is the authoritarian overreaction from governments is very dangerous. There's no, like, I don't understand why people can't see that you can believe all three things. All three things can be true at the same time. This is a very dangerous disease, and it will hurt people. The economic shutdown will hurt people, and the overreaction of governments with regard to crackdowns on civil liberties will also hurt people. All three things are true. And it's been a struggle to watch people as they try to justify to themselves that only two can be true, not all three. No, all three are true for sure. So we need to fight the virus, but the ways to fight the virus are with hand washing and with masks and with social distancing and, you know, with testing, massive amounts of testing, and maybe infrastructure investment into healthcare and, you know, good public education about, you know, how to protect yourself, which obviously would require a rehaul of the WHO and the CDC. But these are all things that can be done to address 95%+ or whatever of all the problems without ever even discussing a crackdown on civil liberties. And then, okay, we can have reasonable discussions about shutting down non-essential businesses for a certain amount of time. Okay, fine. But like these like crazy, the more extreme versions of the lockdowns and anything regarding like mass surveillance, I mean, dude, just no.
There's even been some research that's been coming out recently, basically highlighting that the decrease in mobility that's been brought on by the shelter in place orders and the closure of businesses has actually been ineffective at slowing the spread of the virus. And in some cases has actually made it worse, which I find really interesting, you know, to look at that data and
look, I people in my family have gotten sick. Like I have a lot of respect for this virus. It is a serious thing. So when will I feel comfortable going out again? We'll see. I mean, I take a lot of precautions. And I think a lot of people will do the same. And I think it would be silly to imagine that we're going to have like concerts or sports this year. That's probably not going to happen. There's just too much liability. However, I like to think that the way that the state of California right now, like I think the state's got some problems, but like generally speaking, I can leave my house whenever I want. I can go wherever I want. I can go shopping. I can do what I want. I'm not in any way restricted. And that compares very favorably to what's happening in like Paris or Wuhan, where there's like a crazy lockdown where you need to have like permission to leave your house. Like I think that's the wrong way to do it. I think what the Bay Area has done has been a pretty good balancing act in terms of the sort of enforced restrictions on certain things. Like, sure, shut the parking lots down of national parks. If you still want to go, you can go. It just makes it a little harder. Like, let's just use like choice architecture to like encourage people to restrict their gatherings. I mean, I think that's totally fine. I just think that a lot of people have gone way overboard. We want people to be outside. We want people to be hiking around and, you know, in the great outdoors. A lot of people don't live in a home in the suburbs. A lot of people live in an apartment building. They need to get outside. So it's like, we need to really think about this carefully. But I think California, generally speaking, okay, we've had 1,500 deaths, which is a lot. It's crazy to think about, but it's a nation area, quote unquote, of 42 million people. So if you actually compare it, you know, the response here has compared very favorably with like places like a lot of the countries in Europe and other parts of the country in the United States. So I think California, we'll see, but if it continues to like improve, then it will be a good example of like, hey, you can fight this thing while not having a crazy restrictive lockdown and without doing mass surveillance. So we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. And I totally with you there. I think that it's probably preferable the response you've seen in California than as a place like Michigan, even. You know, you don't even have to go to the other side of the world.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert on what's happening like in each part of the United States, but I'm reasonably a fan of what's happening here.
Right. Well, so in Michigan, people were prohibited from buying pretty much anything other than food in stores, food and medicine, which is just kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, look, dude, you want to go to Costco, go for it. I mean, it's going to have a limited selection. There's going to be a lot of fucking people there, and I hope you're wearing masks. But, like, yeah, the idea that it should be shut seems like probably not something that's well thought out long term.
All right, Alex, well, let's wrap this up. I know you got to get going. Any parting words for the listeners anywhere? Can you point them to where they can find you, get in contact with you?
Sure. Well, follow the Human Rights Foundation at hrf.org. Follow me at Gladstein on Twitter, Gladstein. Just as parting thought, there are a lot of crises. They happen all the time in history. They generally are not good excuses for you to give up your liberties in exchange for security. We have seen this many, many times. In fact, they are opportunities for us to double down on civil liberties and on protecting them. This is when the future is really forged, is now. Are we going to live in a future where we have like micro Bluetooth tracking of our movements and who we meet and who we interact with? Or are we not? I mean, that decision is being made right now. So, and sure, you can leave your phone at home for now if you don't like what ends up happening. If we are unable to resist the Google Apple thing and it ends up being rolled out, for now you can avoid it. But you know, most people have a Google phone. Most people have an Apple phone, and they won't be able to avoid it, or they won't be able to afford to avoid it. And then what happens when we get closer to more common use of wearables, and then eventually more common use of chips in people? And I just think, like, again, we got to fight these things now. It'll be much harder later to undo. There's nothing more permanent than a temporary measure. So let's just think about that. Remember, make them prove to you that the mass surveillance is effective before you even can have that conversation. And they can't prove that to you right now. So it should be a non-starter. They should be all these people dedicating their time to building a privacy-preserving contact tracing app should be doing other stuff. They should be helping frontline nurses. They should be helping hire teams of actual contact tracers. They should be working on vaccines. They should not be doing that, okay? So that's, I guess, my parting thought. And I generally have one piece of advice for folks as we kind of buckle down into this thing and try to ride it out. Use encryption, you know, as much as you can. Try to normalize encryption, normalize the incredible thing we still have today where we have things like PGP and Signal and we can communicate with each other privately. It's really cool that we live in a world where we can do that. Engage with Bitcoin, learn about Bitcoin, use it, opt into it. If you don't like what's happening in the broader economic political sphere, you can opt into a different system that's not controlled by governments and corporations, that is open source and known to all and not rigged. And I think that's really neat. And be kind and be empathetic and just be aware of what's happening both in your communities but also around the world. And I think if we think hard about practicing action in those three areas, we'll be better off for it.
All right, guys, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Alex. Like I said, someone I admire very much, and I've been very excited to get the opportunity to speak with him. I can't speak for Alex, and I certainly wouldn't want to. And it's unfortunate that we didn't have more time to delve deeper into some of the economics behind what's going on, and as well as the virus. But, you know, that's kind of the nature of doing a one-hour podcast. So hopefully you guys understand. We're just trying to cover as much as we can in the time that we have, without me beating single points to the point where we can't have the general broader discussion. I actually think it's quite unfortunate that the current events have to dominate the narrative of conversation so much lately. I would much rather be talking about economics and Bitcoin, because I do feel like that is currently the biggest and most solvable issue facing humanity, which is the plague of the boom and bust cycle created by central banking and the theft of our time and wealth through the monetary system. But I do think that the data that's coming out now is becoming increasingly clear that the reaction to COVID is probably very much overdramatic and in a lot of ways very confusing, and maybe sparks some conspiratorial thoughts about what exactly it is might be going on. What I know for certain is that the economic damage that is being done by the overreaction will very likely have much, much greater consequences, and that's a problem. And I will just want to highlight that, you know, I don't want people to necessarily get into battles over data because I'm not a statistician and I'm not a doctor. But I do spend a lot of time studying economics, and I do know that if people can't work, then they can't feed their families. And society as a whole pretty much falls apart when people can't make a living for themselves. And that's really concerning. Anyway, if you guys enjoyed the interview, please give me a review or some stars or whatever on whatever platform you're listening to us on. You can find the Bitcoin Echo Chamber on pretty much all of your favorite podcasting services, whether it be iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify. I just distribute the podcast to a podcast catcher, and it goes out to all of those automatically. If you guys want to get in contact with me, you can find me on Twitter at heavilyarmedc, that's the letter C, or you can email me at bitcoinechochamber@gmail.com. You can find all of our episodes at bitcoinechochamber.com. And that's pretty much all I got for you guys. Feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. My DMs are always open. Happy to chat with you guys about Bitcoin. I love talking about it with whoever wants to. So thanks for listening. I will see you guys in the next one.